This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. In this episode, we talk with Captain Shem Malmquist about a range of air safety issues, from human factors to flight sims to lithium batteries, and how we need better methods to manage risk. In the news, we discuss the Southwest Airlines Pilots Association complaints about pilot wages, a survey on frequent flyer rewards programs, a notice of proposed rulemaking that would change FAR Part 61, third-class medical reform in yet more legislation, and a two-seat Robinson R-44. David has an on-fire history segment, and Rob talks TSA. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 401 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. With me is first our favorite aviation historian, David Vanderhoof.
Hey, Max. Hi, guys. Looking forward to a good evening tonight.
All right. Also joining us as co-host is Rob Mark. He's an aviation journalist, publishes the Jetwine blog. He's, of course, a pilot, flight instructor.
Well, good evening to everybody, and I just want everybody to know that tonight I am joined by my able assistant here in the studio, Simba the Wonder Dog.
I remember one time when Simba the Wonder Dog was assisting you, fell asleep underneath the table, woke up somewhere in the middle of the podcast, stood
and
up.
Yanked all the cables. Yeah. Amen. We've had a chat with him since then.
Okay, good, good. Also here is the other Max. Max Trescott. He's a CFI, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. Hey, Max.
Hey, hello, Max, and fellow co-hosts. I got to tell you, I am so excited to be here this week because, you know, I understand it's episode 400, so I think that's really cool. So,
you missed last week. You missed what? It. You missed 400.
No, you guys did it without me?
Yeah, we did.
No, that's not true. That's not true. I actually said keep the blue side up at the end in your honor.
Yes, you did.
Well, I heard that. And by the way, my claim is that I missed one episode, and so this is actually my episode 400. So that's why I figured I could claim that.
All right. Sounds
anyway,
good.
Anyway, good to be here.
Our other co-host, our associate producer, actually, Brian Coleman, is off this week. He's traveling as we record this, so he wasn't able to make it, but we'll soldier on without him. Our guest this episode is Captain Shem Malmquist. He has one of those really broad aviation backgrounds. In his case, ranges from teaching aerobatics to instructing in a wide variety of both GA and transport aircraft, academic research, safety investigation. I think Shem has done it all. He's worked as an instructor and evaluator on several transport aircraft, served as flight crew on the Embraer EMB-110, the Shorts 360, the 727, DC-8, 747, and MD-11. And he continues working a full flight schedule, mostly international long-haul flights. Now, Shem has been involved with the ALPA, the Airline Pilots Association National Charting and Instrument Procedures Committee. He was selected to be chairman of his airline's safety committee, also chairman of his airline's aircraft design and operations committee. And as a flight duty officer, he's led several initiatives, including a volcanic ash avoidance plan, air security procedures, and a number of regulatory compliance issues. He's also completed NTSB's accident investigation training. He became party coordinator for an MD-11 accident in Newark, New Jersey. He was also on the GO team for an MD-11 accident in Japan at Narita. Captain Malmquist has also served on the Commercial Aviation Safety Team, or CAST. He's also a speaker. He's authored a number of flight safety and operations articles. Shem, I think there's probably a lot that I've left out, but I think our listeners get the idea that you've been kind of kicking around aviation for quite some time.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I've been actively involved. I've never was somebody that could sit silently and be one of those people that nobody noticed, you know, as they come and go. I seem to be always right in the middle of things somehow or another.
Well, that's pretty exciting. That makes for an interesting career, an interesting life. And we'll probe some of those topics that you know very well. But first, we're going to start with some of the aviation news from the past week. So I'll ask all of you guys, are you ready?
Ready from the West.
Yeah.
Enjoying my dinner.
We'll start with an article from Aviation Pros. This is Southwest Pilots Sioux City of Chicago over billboard advertising. Well, to start this story off, the Southwest Airlines shareholders meeting is May 18th in Chicago. That's 2016, of course. And SWAPA, the Southwest Airlines Pilot Association, wants to complain about pilot wages. Including on a billboard at Chicago Midway International Airport. Now, as the article reports from a few days ago, City Hall says they can't do that. And so the union brought a suit against the city of Chicago, claiming that it represented an unconstitutional restriction of their First Amendment rights. And they asked for a temporary restraining order to allow the pilots to display the ad. And Rob, this is probably big news in your area.
And they got it.
And they did, didn't they?
Yes. So the City Hall is, I'm sure, knowing the reputation our city has for aviation. And for those of you that don't know what it is, this is the city that closed Meg's. But they pretty much like their passenger facility charges and that sort of thing. But as far as the rest of it, if they could just get those big airplanes to go someplace else, they would be very happy.
Well, the union is trying to make the point that, among other things, that the pilots there haven't had a raise since 2011. And their billboard is up now, I guess. And I don't know what effect it'll have on the board of directors meeting, but it seems like all the publicity associated with this controversy over the billboard has brought more attention to this issue maybe than the union could have done just strictly with the billboard if that had gone up from the start.
Gee, you think? I'll tell you. I'm sure the folks in Dallas are not real happy about this, but the Southwest pilots have been in federal mediation for I forgot how long. It's been a while, but they can't seem to get to first base with the Southwest management folks, and most of the rest of the airline industry has pretty much, and Shem, you may want to jump in on this because you may know more about it than I do, but I think most of the majors have kind of caught up to where pilots should have been pay-wise, but the Southwest guys have not.
Yeah, I'm not sure that anybody would say that we're caught up.
I didn't say that. I just implied.
However, I mean, that said, you know, the UPS pilots are, I think, in worse straits than the Southwest. But it's been a long time, and, you know, they're looking at really quite high profits for the companies, and, you know, they're not ready to accept what I think a lot of consider a concessionary contract, which was the last one that they actually rejected. So it's going to be very interesting to watch.
Well, and I think that's always been the question I've had is that, you know, I've always admitted my bias. I like Southwest. I fly them a lot. They're nice folks. But I'm a big believer in the fact that when the company does well, they ought to pay the people back that took the cuts during the hard times. And why Southwest is being so stubborn about this, I have no idea.
Couldn't be the money, I'm sure.
Oh, different time. They also have, I think they're looking, probably the management, the future competition with Allegiant out there, you know, despite their, obviously, a lot of issues that they're having, as we see in the press. And I don't know a lot directly about it other than what I'm reading in the various journals, but obviously quite a few air turnbacks and other safety issues that seem to be cropping up. So Southwest is still one of the really good carriers in terms of safety and culture and a lot of those other aspects, and they have been historically. So they really hopefully will be able to fix this aspect and keep things trucking along, because overall, I agree with you. I think it's a great carrier. I really like flying on them, and their people are great to work with, and I've really enjoyed them.
Well, I was kind of surprised when I heard the number of new hires that have left thought they were going to the greatest airline in the world or whatever, but somehow got there and found out it wasn't what they wanted. And then with the money issues that were going on, they kind of picked up and went someplace else. You don't hear about that very often.
No. I mean, all the airlines have it as they go through various contract negotiations. It's an interesting model. I think that they do have to keep their pay up. Partly, if you look at the kind of flying they do, you know, a lot of the pilots, you know, some people really love, you know, just, you know, flying around the U.S. and flying a lot of legs. But a lot of pilots also look at, you know, the idea of long haul or international as being their ultimate goal. So that there is a crossover there where you need to look at the pay to keep people, you know, happy and satisfied with what they're doing, really.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what you're saying, Shem, is that there's sort of a draw for some pilots anyway, for a kind of the kind of route that Southwest doesn't really offer. And Southwest has to be mindful of that.
Right. I would say that would be true for any carrier, just because pilots do like variety, you know, and it allows a little bit more flexibility when they're in a carrier that has the opportunity to, you know, if you want to fly just out to Asia and back, you can do it. Or else if you want to fly the domestic and bounce around in the U.S., you can do that as well. So both have pluses and minuses, really. But I think that if you're going to a carrier that only has one option, you're a little bit more limited. It's not like the situation, for example, the military has, and I know that the military is very concerned, and rightfully so, with retention. As I told a couple of senior officers at a meeting a few weeks ago, they were asking me about it, and I said, you know, really, all you have to do really is pay a bit more, because most people won't give up flying their F-16 or, you know, F-35 or whatever they've been assigned if the pay is there to go and fly an airline.
Yeah, I can certainly, sympathize with that. Yeah, given the choice, all things being equal, you know, yeah, where are you going to stick?
Well, but it's a lifestyle question too. As Shem mentioned about people that want to fly internationally, they're not going to choose Southwest as their ultimate destination. They're going to go with Delta or American or United or you know, some international carrier, but. You know, again, if that's your goal, you have to know where to go first. I mean, and Southwest was typically never just a stopping off point for most people. Mm-hmm. It was the ultimate destination. But some of that is changing, or maybe it was always happening. Right. We just weren't aware of it as much.
Well, I think more the environment, you know, the working conditions and the company culture. People enjoyed it so much that it really didn't matter so much, you know, where they were going. And so if they lose that, then, you know, kind of what's left.
All right. Let's talk about the passengers a little bit. And we have an article in the Wall Street Journal from Scott McCartney titled "The Best and Worst Frequent Flyer Rewards Programs for 2016. And this comes about from a Switchfly survey that was conducted by the consulting firm IdeaWorks. And what they're finding is that for 3 years in a row now, free seats open for booking have increased. It's not a whole lot, but at least it's a little bit of an increase. Jay Sorensen, the president of IdeaWorks, says, overall, I think the consumer is better served than the year before. So they have a number of sort of broad conclusions from this survey. As I said, overall reward availability up third year in a row. That was at 76.6% for 2016, meaning that that percentage of the queries for a seat coming from the airline's program yielded a reward seat. 76.6%. Last year it was 74%, and in 2014 it was 72.4%. Some other conclusions and this is not a surprise, I think, that seasonality really matters. Reward seat availability drops significantly in July, right, the peak travel month. Also, long-haul availability has improved significantly over time. It says with 8 airlines having availability scores above 70% for 2016 compared to just 3 back in 2010. So it's interesting, but you know, some of the changes when you look at the reward seat availability by airline, there's some interesting things. Southwest is tied for first in terms of total availability at 100%, tied with Air Berlin. Drops down for Virgin Australia a little bit, JetBlue, Lufthansa, Turkish. Turkish has sort of skyrocketed up 28.6 points, which is a big group. Qantas has gone up significantly. British Airways is down. Air Asia Group is down a lot, 25 points. So it's interesting trends in terms of the availability of reward seats. I think that's something that a lot of people complain about. Too bad we don't have Brian with us. I think he's probably the mileage champ amongst all of us. But what about you guys? Are any of you guys traveling enough to earn enough miles to be able to test the availability of reward seats?
Well, I tell you this, for me at least, whenever I need seats, which is quite a bit, especially getting my daughter up and back to L.A., I've used reward points on Southwest quite a few times. And it's not simply the availability of the seats. That was one issue I took with the story. They mentioned that American was down at the bottom in terms of availability. And to me, it's not just that. I've never had trouble getting a seat on Southwest. But when I could get a seat on an American flight, let's say I wanted to go to Washington, D.C. out of Chicago. There was never a seat available on Chicago, you know, O'Hare direct Dulles or National. I always had to do something ridiculous like, oh, but we have a seat if you want to fly to Dallas and sit there for 3 or 4 hours and then fly back to Washington from there. Sure, I'd love to just spend an entire day of my life to make what is normally about an hour and 15 minute flight because I can have it for free. No, I don't think so. And now I don't fly a lot of the other carriers. I don't fly United. Maybe they do the same thing. Maybe they don't. But I'm saying it's not just about seat availability. It's how the entire trip gets organized, I think.
Well, I think it's always entertaining to look at the comments when these articles allow comments. The Wall Street Journal does, and I guess I would say that in general, the quality of the comments by readers responding to Wall Street Journal articles is a little better than average. But there was one that kind of caught my attention, and this reader of the article says, "I'm platinum middle tier on American, and I'm thinking about switching back to Southwest. The miles just seem to be worthless these days with months of travel required to book a reward trip. I get that the airlines are trying to enjoy some profitability after years of losses, but at some point, these loyalty programs are going to be so diluted, it won't matter to me which airline I fly, as long as the travel is efficient, which is the one thing that Southwest excels at." So I thought it was kind of an interesting comment. Okay, moving on. This is an item from AOPA. Proposed Part 61 changes would benefit GA. Now, the FAA has published a notice of proposed rulemaking in NPRM that would change FAR Part 61, which governs the certification of pilots, flight instructors, and ground instructors. Who can tell us a little more about what this means, what the implications are?
Well, I'll jump in. I've read through this a little bit. It's an NPRM, which means that all of our listeners get an opportunity to comment on it if they've got suggestions on how to do things better. The comments are due by August the 10th, and we'll put a link to the the Federal Register site that has the full MPRM listed in it. But basically, it's going to change a lot of different things. So for folks that are instrument-rated pilots, they will no longer need a flight instructor sitting next to them in a flight simulator to get instrument current. So that's kind of interesting. The point was that if they were getting current in an airplane flying in actual, they wouldn't need a flight instructor to log the approaches. So why require it in a simulator? Also, there's some other odd quirks about simulators. They passed along a regulation in 2009, which said that instead of being have to be current within the past 6 months, if you do it in a simulator, you have to do all that stuff within the past 2 months. So I think they're going to try and make that the same. Also, there's another odd quirk, which is, if you get current in an airplane, you just need 6 approaches. But if you do it in a simulator, in addition, you also need 3 hours and unusual attitudes. And, they're just trying to rationalize it so that the simulator now is treated the same as the airplane. And then for folks working on their commercial ratings, in the past, you had to have at least 10 hours in an aircraft that was complex. So it had flaps and retractable landing gear, constant speed prop. But Cessna has not built any of those since, I think, 1985. And Piper has built 26 of those, I think, since 2007 or 8. So what they finally decided is that modern TAA aircraft, so technically advanced aircraft, those with a glass cockpit, will now be a substitute for those aircraft. So if you want to get your commercial on a 172G1000, apparently you'll be able to do that going forward. And they've done some other small things. Folks who got their sport pilot license can now get full credit for all those hours toward their private, which they were not able to do in the past. So looks to me like this is mostly a kind of a cleanup bill to just kind of rationalize everything and have it make more sense.
And AOPA is very much in favor of these changes.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, and I didn't see anything in there that I would imagine people would object to, though. There's always that one guy.
Can you tell me a little more about this terminology, this complex aircraft terminology? So the older airplanes are more complex, quote unquote.
Yeah, and the reason is that in the days of metal airplanes and lots of rivets and all that kind of stuff, that it was fairly effective to suck up the landing gear and pick up a little bit more speed. In the last probably 15 years or so with the Cirrus and the Cessna 400. A lot of manufacturers are just finding that it's not worth the overhead of putting in the extra motors and cables and so on to suck up the landing gear, because the aircraft is so smooth now with the composite airframe that the amount of drag reduction they get by hauling up the gear is not as great as it used to be when they had a pretty draggy airplane to begin with.
So as you mentioned, the process for an NPRM involves opening it up for public comment. And this is everyone's opportunity. If you have an opinion, I guess either positive or otherwise, right? Is it a good idea to voice your opinion in an NPRM and say, "Yeah, I support this"? Does that add value?
I don't think it does. I think that generally in these that, if people don't object, they will move forward with it. There was one NPRM a year or so ago with the FAA was something that, made total sense, and it would have gone forward except I think one or two people objected, and that just greatly delayed the entire process. So I would say, if you like what it says and, none of the things give you heartburn, don't bother commenting because that'll speed things along.
Okay. All right. Well, also from AOPA, we have another item. Defense bill includes medical reform language. I was a little confused on this. So third-class medical reform from the Pilots Bill of Rights, too. It seems like it keeps getting into legislation. It's been in standalone legislation in the Senate, again as part of the Senate's FAA reauthorization bill, and now the Senate Armed Services Committee has put it into the National Defense Authorization Act. Is this the same thing that keeps going in just in different places? And if it's so popular, why don't we just have it by now?
Well, I think we have a Congress that has difficulty passing any bills, so I think they keep trying to slip it into some bill that they think has a high probability of being passed. So, I mean, we all know the dysfunction these days in getting legislation passed. And I think this is just it's kind of emblematic of what people do. Things that are seemingly totally unrelated to a bill that they think might get passed get slipped in. So that's what we've got.
What's the third class medical get us?
Oh, so the just real broadly, there have been varying proposals that go more or less along these lines. If you are flying an aircraft of less than a certain horsepower with fewer than certain number of seats, perhaps less than total weight, then third class medical is not required, which basically means that you can have a driver's license and self-certify that you're healthy. And that's going to save pilots, probably $150 every 2 years or whatever they're paying currently to go see the doctor and get their medical.
All right. As a final item, this from AvWeb, FAA approves two-place R-44. This is a new old Robinson helicopter, I guess. I know Robinson from the R-22, right? That's a two-place helicopter, and the R-44, a four-place helicopter. So now we have a two-place R-44, and what the FAA has certified is the R-44 Cadet. And this is, I guess, essentially the same thing as the R-44, but the rear seats have been removed for more cargo space.
Yeah, I think the whole idea is they wanted to come up with a less expensive trainer. The 44 is just a marvelous trainer. Everybody loves it. It's just a little expensive to operate. The 22, on the other hand, is fairly inexpensive to operate, but it's so special that it has its own special FAR regulation 73 because of the mast bumping problems in that aircraft. Basically, it's got a design issue where you can get in a heck of a lot of trouble and destroy the aircraft in flight if you don't do things properly. The 22 is just a lot less stable, and so it's more challenging to learn how to hover in it. The 44 is an excellent platform to learning to hover. It's just more expensive. So I think they've kind of come up with a nice hybrid aircraft right in the middle. It probably is going to be a really nice sweet spot for the market.
See, that's funny. I thought they took the back seats out of the R-44 because they didn't want anybody giving their helicopter to the teenagers for the weekend because they figured they'd go, make out the back seats or something. But I just took it that way. I guess I was completely wrong.
So that's what the kids have been doing with your helicopter, Rob.
Uh-huh. Yep, that's it.
Well, again, we're speaking with Captain Shem Helmquist. Shem, one thing that is sort of stands out from your bio is your involvement in various aviation safety activities, here and there. So from your perspective, on air safety in general, do you think it's better now than it was, say, 10 or 20 or 30 years ago?
Well, there's no question that flying has gotten safer. I don't think anybody could make any type of cogent argument that it's not. The flying and the accident rates are significantly lower, and that's in a large part due to the improvement in reliability of many of our subcomponents. And as we've moved along, we've been able to reduce the number of accidents that were coming from a lot of causes that in the past were real issues. Failures of components is very, very rare now. And then I guess the next low-hanging fruit after that was probably the controlled flight into terrain type of scenarios. And we took care of that with various methods, some of them procedurally, just better concepts of how we design instrument approach procedures, how we train pilots, how we design procedures and instruments and reliability, in the introduction of these constant descent approaches instead of non-precision approaches in the traditional way has been a great improvement. Of course, the terrain warning systems and the enhanced ground proximity warning systems have been an amazing improvement in terms of those kinds of things. The automation has improved things in certain ways, but in other ways it's left interesting gaps that I don't think have come to fruition in terms of the problems that we might see in the future or expect to see with them. A big part of that is that pilots today are, particularly in the fly-by-wire airplanes, not really flying the airplane anymore. In the past, in a legacy airplane, even if it's cable hydraulic, as the airplanes were, so you weren't really feeling the controls directly, even so, the pilot had to compensate for various issues or variations that they would encounter in the wind, turbulence, bumps, small defects in the design or the control response. They would have to adjust their control inputs and make corrections accordingly, and so to keep the airplane where they wanted to go. But with any of the fly-by-wire systems, and that includes both the Boeing and the Airbus systems, the fly-by-wire system actually absorbs most of that for you. And so you're not really flying the airplane. So, you know, part of this big push for more hand flying is great. It's fun. But if you're in a fly-by-wire airplane, I'm not sure you're really gaining as much as you think you are. Hmm. And so we have a disconnect there that has opened ourselves up to gaps. So we look at, for example, Air France 447, where you had a case of two pilots up front, both of whom had never flown a jet airplane without fly-by-wire. In addition to that, neither had any significant hand flying, if any, up above 29,000 feet in the reverse, you know, reduced vertical separation minima or RVSM airspace. And all of a sudden, they're handed an airplane that had gone from its normal flight control law, where it's compensating for all of that, to a degraded mode where it's not. Or not in it, not in the same way that they were used to, and laterally not at all. Plus, they're at altitude, and it adds quite a bit to the, I guess, to the task or to the workload if you put somebody in that kind of situation when they really haven't had the experience to do it. So that's a fairly large concern of mine, actually, right now, in terms of looking at the types of accidents we might see in the future. Because what's happened is that I think to a large extent we've had legacy pilots who had the experience flying airplanes before all of these systems were implemented, and also before we had the RVSM airspace, where they actually hand flew airplanes at cruise altitude. I mean, nobody really wanted to do it for long periods of time, but if the autopilot was inoperative, I remember showing up for an airplane in Taipei and hand flying it across the Pacific to North America, you know, just taking turns. And it's something we did. It's something that wouldn't happen today because of the RVSM rules. So some of those kinds of things are just gone. And the pilots, as they begin to retire or move on, who don't have those skills, we might be losing something and we don't even recognize it. We're not training for it, and we're not going to see it until it's too late. And I think that the Air France 447 might have been a little bit of a wake-up for that. But I'm not sure that any of the things we're implementing are quite enough. And that is a concern. Of course, there's a whole other issue with simulation, which is another mess in terms of trying to train pilots and the accuracy of simulation. So there's some interesting new problems that are coming along. But in general, in answer to your question, you know, flying is certainly safer than it used to be, I think, for the average person. But I think that there's other looming issues out there that our current risk analysis methods are not going to capture.
Do you think that we're taking lessons from the Air France accident and applying them, or are we kind of, we being the industry, let's just say, not reacting as deeply as maybe we should?
Well, I would say that we're taking some of them, but we're maybe, in a certain extent, getting the wrong lessons from them. Now, recently, there's been a big push towards, for example, procedural compliance. And following procedures is a big part of what has made airline flying safe. There's no question about it. But at the same time, just telling somebody to follow procedures is not a prescription to fix the problem.
Sure.
For example, yeah. You know, we look at Asiana going into San Francisco, and they were, you know, the crew was, you know, for lack of a better word, dinged for not following procedures. but I don't think anyone sat back and thought, why did they not follow the procedures and really understood that. Another example of that would be the Gulfstream accident where the control lock was left in place. I don't think that it's probably fair to say that they hadn't developed their own procedures, and the fact that they didn't read a checklist out loud doesn't mean that they weren't performing one, or they might have reverted to hand signals. It's possible that maybe they were taxiing out one day and they almost had a runway incursion, or it did have a runway incursion because they were reading a checklist and they decided, well, the greater risk is talking out loud or being distracted, and they switched their procedures. And as complicated as, you know, the Gulfstream is, after a long time flying it, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're flying a Gulfstream or 777. After a while, it becomes pretty routine. You can go through flows and capture the things, and then one day they just get distracted and missed it.
But in that case, Shem, I don't know. I'm not so certain I agree with you on that, because the one issue with the Gulf, the G4 that went in, was that it's not exactly as if they missed the control checks that one time, because as you said, maybe they got distracted or this, that. I mean, the data systems in the Gulfstream showed that whoever had been flying that airplane for the past 100 flights had never done a control check. Pitch up and nothing. So that's what you want to call not following procedures or whatever. That's some complacency that really, you know, got them in serious trouble.
Right, well, but what is the root training of that? You know, that's really the question. In other words, you can say they're complacent, or you should pay more attention to detail, or you need to do more, but is that going to really make somebody do it? I mean, when you think of procedures, here's another way to look at that. So let's take driving down the highway. How many times when you're driving on a highway, a freeway, or interstate, or whatever you want to call it, depending on what part of the country you're in, parkway, how many times do you drive over the speed limit? What percentage of the time do you think if there's no traffic?
Yeah, it's probably pretty high.
So we're driving, and we know that that's not the law, and we're not supposed to be doing it, but we're driving faster. Now, what conditions will lead you to slow down?
A cop.
Right. Okay. So if you're being observed, or you know you're being observed, and you have a risk from that, then that will make you slow down. But you're not really slowing down because of a safety issue. You're slowing down because you're worried about getting caught.
Right.
Obviously, you've made a judgment where you feel that it is as safe to go faster. And in some respects, you're even making a trade-off. For example, let's say you have an injured person, or you're driving, you know, and you have an injured child, and you're on your way to the hospital. You're making a trade-off between the risk of driving faster and the risk of your family or your loved one. And these are all the kinds of decisions we make as humans. But the other thing that would get you to slow down is something, for example, like debris on the roadway, or clearly seeing ice or something like that. So, you know, those things are clearly risk factors. Now, when you come down to following procedures, what's going to get you to follow the procedures is either the fear of being caught or being observed, or the other possibility is that you actually are aware of some kind of risk or danger in front of you. But then the problem is awareness. Now, if these pilots had been flying, I think it was 176 flights or something like that that we know, and probably far more than that, without doing the control check most of the time, they obviously didn't perceive it as a risk, and they had no reason to think it was a risk. They were doing it the same way. The best way to understand where something goes wrong is to first understand, why did it go right so many times?
That's a good point.
The problem with it going right so many times is you start to think, oh, well, I guess that's not necessary. It worked for me, you know, the prior 176 times, so I guess I don't really need to do it. It's not that important.
Right.
But that's the normalization of deviancy, right?
Some of those were a partial control check also, so it doesn't mean that they were necessarily just forgetting it. It might have been that they weren't even really thinking about it, and they were kind of rushing through it. Again, prioritizing different things. But it comes down again, and finally, to not recognizing that there's a risk there in the first place. And if you don't find some way of showing somebody so they recognize it, it's very difficult. So we come back to, let's say, in their training environment. You know, they went through the flight safety training, and I know that there was a follow-on to the investigation where one of the board members said, well, certainly during part of that training, that they had had, you know, they'd been observed and they had followed those procedures. I would argue that not necessarily. You know, most of training, once you're qualified on an airplane and you've been on it for a while, you're not spending time taxiing and doing the pre-flight checks. They're going to pop you right on the runway. You know, they might give you a couple engine or start problems, and it's very probable they didn't do anything as far as a taxi out. So I'm not sure that that's a that is an accurate argument. I think that they had gotten to a point where they somehow were skipping in their procedures and not really remembering that it was even part of it. They went through some kind of flow or something that had developed over time that they felt was accomplishing all the items. And they may have had a rational reason for feeling that that was a safer way to do it. And so the only way to get around that then is to somehow present that problem as a kind of a thermal scar. You put them in a simulator and all of a sudden they crash because of it. So you need to set them up, but then you also have to know that that's an issue to begin with. My guess is that pilots going through flight safety now are being observed on control checks, and it's being an emphasis item for instructors because that's normally how it goes. But then there's some other issue lurking out there that we haven't yet recognized, and that's something that we need to consider.
Shem, what's going on with regard to flight simulators these days that is something we should know about and understand?
Well, the whole Rule 60, and I think your last week's guest talked about it a bit as well.
Yes.
There's a rule for flight simulation to require obtaining the modeling, first of all, which is a real problem, and that was discussed at some length last week, for the flight simulators so we can stall it back to 10 degrees more than the stall angle of attack. Traditionally, simulation has been used just up to essentially the first stall warning. And so this is really quite a change, and this requires a difference in the stall modeling itself. One of the problems, though, is that a lot of people don't recognize that flight simulators are not that accurately modeled. They're only modeled as well as the parameters that are put into them. And they're only modeled well for certain things that are intended to be trained. So they can't model anything that isn't in the database or hasn't been trained or isn't intended to be trained. High altitude stall is a great example because the simulator, even with the more robust models, and I've flown their more robust models because they've installed it on the FAA simulators in Oklahoma City, and I got to fly both their 737 and A330 and pull them back and do the full stalls and really experience it. But even that is not as rough, and you don't experience the negative G-forces that you would in the real event. So it's a problem. But at least with the instructors being better trained and more knowledgeable, we can move forward and hopefully get people more aware. But an equally big problem of all this is the lack of education in understanding the aerodynamics that have to do with big airplanes. Well, heck, even light airplanes, but big airplanes are different than a light airplane. So the assumption that if we're stalling in a big airplane, it's going to handle and you're going to see the same kinds of indications as you would in a light airplane, it's just not accurate. And that, I think, is a really big problem, but it's a trainable problem, but it's a big one. And it goes along with us not training meteorology, not training how to work onboard radar systems. There's a whole host of aspects that we're leaving a big gap in. And one of my big concerns is that we only train those things that we perceive that there is a risk of. So we put things that are either mandated or we think it might happen, and then we train them for it. Once there's an accident, then all of a sudden we add that to the syllabus. But we don't train for things that we don't perceive as risk. There's just simply not enough training time. And so a training manager makes a logical and very rational decision to train those things that they perceive a risk for. In the meantime, the pilot community is losing the resilience in order to be able to handle those things that we did not anticipate. Because the truth is that an airplane accident is not a simple chain of events. The Swiss cheese kind of linear model is just not an accurate portrayal unless you look at it in hindsight. Those things only line up in hindsight. But if you're looking forward, you have an infinite range of possibilities that you can see from every single point and what you're paying attention to, what's salient, what's not salient. All of those things are different when you're looking from, when you're, as they say, in the tunnel looking forward. And it changes the entire way we need to look at accidents, because these new accidents that we're seeing are a result of the interaction of complex portions from software to the human component, hardware, all of which interacting in very complex ways, and it makes it very hard to predict. And in fact, an accident is actually would be an emergent property of a complex system. So it's really a different way of looking at it. And I've been fortunate in the last couple of years, or last few years, to have been able to work with people such as Nancy Levison, some great exchanges with Sydney Decker, as well as Eric Holnagel, a whole group that's pushing for resilience engineering and taking a different approach to how we look at these complex accidents. Because the only way we're going to find them is not through traditional methods, where we think that we can break down the accident into subcomponents, and each component, we then solve that one component and we'll solve the accident. In actual fact, each component affects every other one, and you do something on one piece of it, and it may actually have an adverse effect on other ones. So it's a much more complex problem than I think that we tend to understand. It's also a problem I think we're going to see with limitations on how we're handling risk analysis and how we're handling the safety management systems. I think those are great for looking at the more simple problems. Well, we have a very good chance. In fact, we will lower the incident rate, but we won't necessarily stop the next accident, at least with the current methods, and that's a concern.
So that's very interesting. Is the strategy then that we improve our methods for looking ahead into the future to anticipate those complex systems? Or is it instead addressing how we solve problems, when they occur? In other words, is it improving the predictive capabilities, or is it improving the human being's ability to deal with something that we say is just unpredictable, or something else? You see where I'm going?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. We'll start with the human. Our whole concept of error is, I would say, fundamentally flawed. And one of the ways to think about this is that we design procedures or computers or equipment to operate, and we say they're very reliable, but they're actually only reliable as long as a human is keeping them within a very tight environment. Your computer is not going to be very reliable if you allow it to fall off the table. It's not going to be very reliable if the temperature is out of range or anything like that. The procedures that we design for flying airplanes are very reliable as long as a human is adjusting and making up the gap between what's happening in the real world and the idealized world in which they were thought out. The same thing for all of our computer systems, our automation, everything that we have in the entire aerospace system, including air traffic control and meteorology. Everything is designed to work under somewhat idealized conditions, and it really depends on the human to make up that gap between reality and that idealized condition that it takes to operate. And when you look at it from that perspective, you start to see that a human error, because people aren't setting out to make a mistake, people are actually trying to do the right thing. So the error then comes out to not so much that the person just goofed up, as in most cases, they just were putting on too much for the human to be able to make up for that gap. And then when they can't do it, we blame them for it.
Yes.
So yeah. we're really tasking them to make up a gap that is impossible under certain circumstances. It might be that they're fatigued or some other thing, but for whatever reason, they're not able to do it. So the first thing is to do what we can to improve the resilience of the human. Part of that is design the systems with that in mind and understanding those concepts. But the other is that we need to understand the ability of humans and look at it from those perspectives. I think that it changes a lot of the ways we design systems, and we also have to increase the training and the ability and the knowledge. Right now, we've had a long-term trend of pilots getting less and less training on systems, less and less training on meteorology. Well, heck, most pilots haven't had any more meteorology training since they started their initial training, whether they were a private pilot or initial pilot training in the military. They didn't get anything after that.
So I was really interested by your concept there, human error. Do you think we ought to be training people to recognize impending overload?
Absolutely. And it's something that we actually are doing to a certain extent. I think that the better crew resource management programs are talking about that and having people try to monitor each other, which is good. But sometimes you can't really tell the overload. And the other part is that the human factors component that is being missed is that we need to have people knowledgeable enough so they can make decisions when they encounter something entirely new that you didn't predict. And that requires real system knowledge, real aerodynamic knowledge, real understanding of why the procedures are in place. And that is the kind of training that nobody seems to be willing to pay for. But it does make a difference. It also answers something that I've wondered about for a lot of years, which was when I look at the people that are involved in various safety work or the technical work at the airlines, they seem to have, well, I know they have actually a lower incident rate than the general pilot population. You think, well, why would that be? And part of it might just be that they're more immersed in it. They're more knowledgeable. So they're using that knowledge to, it's not that they're guarding against it. It's not that they might not be complacent, but they actually are more knowledgeable. And knowledge itself is a good guard against complacency. Because again, someone is going to become complacent if they don't know the risks of not being complacent.
Yeah, they're going to know a lot more if it's their day job as opposed to, being a weekend warrior. So I think that makes total sense.
Right. Well, it's also a difference of even a pilot that spends all their days off sailing their sailboat, or playing golf, as opposed
or to selling, somebody selling real estate.
Right. Or who is just immersed in it on a day-to-day basis on one level or another. I think that makes a great deal of difference. So the other part is the predictive. And there are ways to get at prediction. And when I did a talk last week, I become associated with the film Pilot Error, and we're actually working on a new book on that's going to get a lot more in-depth and look at these issues that happened with not only Air France 447 and bringing up a lot of new things to light that haven't been brought out at all before, but in addition, looking at how we can utilize that type of knowledge towards complex systems and understanding what you might call emergent properties in a better way. And it was really interesting because when I mentioned the concept of emergent properties and complex systems, you could immediately tell the physicists in the room because their eyes lit up immediately. And that was it was pretty funny. But the reality is that the same things that lead us to not being able to predict an accident are the same reasons that nobody predicted the current political race with Donald Trump coming to the top. These are emergent properties from a complex system. And we can apply the same to all sorts of things that we're looking at. And we look in hindsight, whether it's the savings and loan meltdown or the mortgage problems, these all were, again, not predicted using traditional hazard analysis methods. Or a great example that now Nancy Levison uses, and my apologies to Boeing, but the risk analysis that they had used showed that the risk of a lithium battery fire was, I believe it was 10 to the minus 7th, so one in every 10 million flight hours. And it turned out that they have had two in the first 52,000 hours. So that's a kind of a telling indication that our methods of risk analysis may be fundamentally flawed.
Shem, is there some overarching organization or process or something that kind of coordinates how we navigate through these issues? Or is it just sort of random, this organization in this country is looking at this aspect and that one in that country is looking at some other aspect? Is there anything that's coordinating all of this?
I wouldn't say that there is directly. There's a group of people that are making some headway in this resilience engineering. It was started by David Wood at Ohio State. And they are making some progress. I know that the European, for example, Eurocontrol is beginning to implement some of those concepts. But there's no overreaching organization. Most of the organizations are aware of it at the higher levels, but at most of the other levels, they're really not. They're really stuck in the same types of concepts they've been using for a lot of years. And the airlines, a lot of the concepts that are being implemented in with the safety management systems are based on theory that was developed actually in the 1970s. And this is a rapidly evolving field, and we really are progressing as the conservatism of the industry in terms of wanting to change or taking on new concepts is very interesting, and it's can be our own worst enemy. But on the other hand, I understand from a liability perspective, people are very, very reticent to make changes. So it's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. It's fascinating stuff. And sometimes it's sort of difficult to think about it, to try to wrap your head around you know, what does it mean, particularly for people who are, you know, more driven by sort of the practical aspects of things. But, I mean, this is key to, you know, everything that underlies, I think, the, you know, the safety systems that we have in place. Are there any resources that you might recommend to us where we can, you know, learn more about some of these subjects or places where we could follow the developments in these areas, or is there a place where you personally are online that we can pass along to our listeners?
Well, I'm working on some things online. I think as far as the easiest read, I would recommend for the people that are involved in aviation, some of Sidney Ducker's books. And it's, you know, I really, and he's basing his work on the work of others as well, and he'd be the first to say that. The reason I just recommend Sidney Ducker is he's also a current first officer for one of the Australian airlines, and so he's actually involved with it at that level. And in a certain way, they seem to be a little bit easier to read if you're a pilot than some of the other ones, a little bit less academic feeling. And he's has, well, one of the nicest one is that he's written is called The Field Guide to Human Error. And it's really a pretty relatively easy read, and it's quite good. And it gets into a lot of these concepts and a lot of the history of how we came to think of risk and causality the way we do and why it's flawed and why we really need to change. So that's really interesting. Now, I do have a blog, which I probably should keep more active, but it's airlinesafety.wordpress.com, and I keep that up. I have a Facebook page that's just Jet Safety, and so I keep active with that as well, somewhat. But it really, you know, both of which just get, bypassed by a lot of the other constant projects that I've been working on. You know, a big one right now, of course, is this lithium battery. I'm trying to mitigate risks with that, and there's a real complex system, and it's a difficult one because lithium batteries are everywhere. Yeah, the Royal Aeronautical Society did a study a few years ago that they estimated 500 lithium batteries on every single average commercial airline flight. So they are just everywhere, and shipping them, of course, their medical devices depend on them. So it's really turning out to be a challenge.
And you're on a committee that's taking a look at that, aren't you?
Yes, I'm working with the SAE, the Society of Automotive Engineers, which you wouldn't think would be involved in aviation, actually is handling more and more of the standards for aviation and the military as well. They're, a lot of the MIL standards are slowly propagating over to the various SAE committees. So this committee, this particular committee, is just tasked with trying to figure out packaging in order to mitigate the risk, you know, something that will hopefully keep a fire from propagating long enough for the airplane to get on the ground. And that's a big problem. It's a huge working group. I think there's probably a couple of hundred people on it, wow, which makes it
that's big.
Challenging. It actually a real challenge to read through all the comments on any paper. Tell you, occupying way too much time. So we're working on that, but also on a flight deck handling qualities working group, and been involved with a lot of different aspects from just safety in general, I guess across the industry. So it definitely keeps you busy, but it's interesting at the same time.
Wow. One final quick question. What are your thoughts about drones? Is this something that represents a great threat to manned aviation, in your opinion?
Well, I would actually say not. And my feeling on the drones is that one of the things that people have missed, and there's, by the way, a great book by David Mendel, who was a professor at MIT, and he actually created a lot of the autonomous vehicles that I'd highly recommend. Great read. But the autonomous vehicles, or the ability to eliminate pilots, I think is really overstated based on our current understanding. And a big part of that, I think you can understand looking at, for example, a driverless vehicle. I think Google is seeming to be successful, although I would agree with David Mendel that they are operating their tests under somewhat idealized conditions, and so it looks a little bit better than it is. I don't know what it will do if it's on a snow-covered road up in the Northeast, for example.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's already having problems with just basic construction. How is it going to handle if you're driving along and it turns up a street and there's like an armed robbery or two rival, street gangs getting ready to face off? How will you program it to recognize that? These are the kinds of problems that are really, really difficult. But they also go into some of the subjective types of things. Like, let's say, again, you're driving along and you have your driverless car and you have your child who just injured and bleeding is going to die if they don't get to the hospital right away. Are you going to be able to make it go faster? Who takes on that risk? How do you handle that? Now, from a flying perspective, the pilots are making those kinds of decisions all the time. You have a passenger that's sick, or take the risk and obviously ultimately the incorrect decision that the Swiss Air crew made going in with the fire going into, I guess it was Halifax.
Nova Scotia.
Yeah, so they had to make a decision. Now, do we bypass our procedures and land overweight right away to an unfamiliar airport and that risk against the risk of how quickly this fire will propagate? In that case, they made the wrong decision. But other cases, you know, you're flying over the mid-ocean and lithium batteries light up. Do you make a decision to ditch on the water or try to continue to the nearest remote field? How do you program a computer to make that kind of decision? And again, maybe you make it so it's going to do the least lives possible. It's that old ethical question of if you have the ability to push somebody off next to you into the path of an oncoming train to save the lives of, you know, five others, do you do it? Mm. But these are the kinds of things that I think are going to be a real problem in terms of what computers can do. And it is not clear that we're going to be able to get there immediately, at least until we get to human level types of artificial intelligence or something close to that. And once we have that kind of capability, so many things change. It's such a game changer across the entire world. The world life as we know it could very well cease to exist. I think there's, you know, Elon Musk says he spends a third of his waking hours worrying about that. So, so we have a whole other set of problems once we get computers to the capability that really could do that.
I think there's actually one new technology that's really making great progress, and that's the machine learning. I was talking with Alan Eustace over the weekend. He's a PhD computer scientist who also beat Felix Baumgarten's record for a free fall from 135,000 feet. And he was saying that machine learning has greatly changed voice recognition. So just think back, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, voice recognition was garbage. And yet suddenly, in just a very short period of time, they leapt forward from the algorithms that scientists could come up to the algorithms that the machines themselves created. And I think right. That may be the one area where if we look at what machine learning can do, this probably could do a better job of sucking in all the data and spitting out answers for things that, you know, humans may in the past been slow to reach a conclusion on. I'm actually optimistic that we may be on the verge of some big breakthroughs in computing, because we're getting beyond, you know, the programs that scientists can conceive to the ones that machines themselves are creating by analyzing, you know, reams and reams of data.
And it's going to be an interesting problem, but at the same time, machine learning can lead to some very bad outcomes also, which is why people are worried about it. So, you know, if you have the, depending on the underlying architecture, what it's programmed to do, it can become very good at that to the exclusion of anything else that might be of value to humans. And so there is a risk factor, and that's something that that's the factor that they're worried about. But we still have other issues that I think that I don't know how they'll be tackled, but I suppose it's possible. Redundancy. You know, right now, we do have the fortune of the human being completely independently powered and not dependent on any outside electrical source. And that's useful. At least it seems to be for the most part. And if we accomplish this resilience aspect, then the human doesn't become a liability. You know, part of the whole push for this is the concept that 80% of the accidents are caused by human error. But if error is not really the same thing as what people are thinking, and instead it's a lack of resilience and the way we're designing our systems, then we might have a better path forward in designing systems with that assist the human to make decisions, but you don't take the person out of the loop entirely. And I think no matter what we do, we're going to have humans in the loop designing or constraining what the vehicle does. So we're not actually eliminating people in the same way. It's just a matter of whether people are going to be getting on an airplane and ride on it without anybody out front. And that seems to be somewhere that right now a lot of people are, I guess, concerned about. Yeah. But it's hard to say, I mean, how people will feel with that. And then if you start looking at the risk of accidents, it's going to really depend on a lot of factors. And then there's the liability factor. You know, who is liable if a Google car crashes? How do you handle that?
Right. Yeah, I think the only thing that's really clear is that the future is going to be a lot different than it is today. But what that future is going to look like, I don't know. And whether that applies to self-driving cars or unmanned aircraft or whatever it is, I think it'll be very interesting for those of us who are around to see it. But
one thing you can say for sure, like you just said, is that we can't really predict exactly what's going to happen and how it will happen. I think it'll be different than anybody expects.
Yes.
Assuming that we're around to see it and we don't, and it somehow doesn't go wrong, which is, as you may have heard, one of the theories out there that would explain Fermi's paradox that we haven't found life outside of our planet, is that they each reach a certain point where they wipe themselves out either through nuclear weapons or supercomputers. So.
Or they've observed us and they don't want to make contact.
Yes, which may be more likely. But all right, well, Shem, we want to thank you so much for joining us on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Very fascinating conversation, a lot of things to think about. And again, thanks a lot for taking the time to speak to us and to all of our listeners.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the opportunity.
And now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, with the airplane of the week.
I was going to do the Mirage 3 today,
but
I saw the following article. The F-35 stealth fighter's dirty little secret is now out in the open.
Okay. What is that about?
The secret? Wait for it. That the F-35 is actually three planes with only some commonality between them. So my reaction initially was, no, insert expletive here, Sherlock. This is news to some people? To quote my boss, really? Seriously? Under what rock do these people live? Let me see. Let's start with, there is no such thing as commonality between the services, with the possible exception of a C-130 or a C-47. The Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines all have different missions. If they didn't, we wouldn't need them all, would we? Here are some examples of commonality through the last couple of decades. With the success of the Stuka dive bomber in World War II, the U.S. Army Air Forces requested Douglas to create a land-based variant of the SBD-3, called the A-24 Banshee. Now, did the Army just take an SBD-3 and paint it olive drab over neutral gray? No. It had a new tail wheel, a different engine, a removed tail hook, and different self-defense armament. And it's not just a U.S. thing. The Brits decided they wanted to make a carrier-based version of the Spitfire. Oh, heck, it's just adding a tail hook, right? No, don't forget the folding wings, which modified the landing gear. There were so many changes, Churchill himself canceled it because it was delaying land-based Spitfires, which they desperately needed. Okay, well, it should get easier in the jet age, right? Nope. Let's talk about the legendary F-86 Sabre. Did you know there was a naval version? The Navy created the FJ-1 Fury. The U.S. Air Force liked it. Did they buy it off the rack? Of course not. They swept the wings, reduced the weight, modified the aircraft so much that it was a whole new plane. Well, the Navy liked what the Air Force had done and needed a navalized version of it. Now, for political reasons, they call it the FJ-2 and not the F2J-1 because it's cheaper to buy an existing plane than a whole new one. So they ordered the F-86E with 420mm Colt cannon instead of the 650mm, larger nose wheel, folding wings, harness for catapult launchings, and a whole new front windscreen, causing it to be 500 kilos over the F-86. All the modifications made it difficult to land on a carrier, and they were handed over to land-based marine units. The FJ-3, in essence, became a whole new airplane, so much for commonality. But wait, there's more. The YF-95 was 25% bigger than the F-86. Congress wouldn't pay for a new plane, so it became the F-86D. And suddenly, because it was a variant of that really successful plane, the Sabre, with that, it suddenly had money in the budget. Did we learn our lesson? Now enter the greatest jackass in the history of military procurement, Robert F. McNamara. I'm not even going to bring up the F-111. Let's look at its numeric predecessor, the F-110A Spectre all-weather fighter. Never heard of it? Really? Well, it was forced upon by the U.S. Air Force by the Kennedy administration. The Navy had a two-seat all-weather fighter and ground attack aircraft that was in production and quite successful. Two were provided for testing, and the Air Force decided to purchase the F-4H-1 Phantom II and call it the F-110A Spectre. No problem. They even went with the original gull gray over white paint, with a few, quote, small changes. The F-110 was to carry more ordnance. The main landing gear was beefed up, causing a bigger wheel well and a redesign of the whole wing. The main spine had to be modified for boom refueling with the elimination of the probe. The J-79 GE-15 engines replaced the Dash 8As. Oh, and naval flight officers in Navy back seats don't have flight controls. Air Force wizzos do. So a second set of controls needed to be installed in the rear cockpit. Eventually, in 1962, the Tri-Service Designation System went into effect, and the F-110 became the F-4C Phantom II, making the USAF and the USAN flying the same plane. Right. Creative accounting from the master McNamara. As you trace the line, you see that the Air Force versus the Navy Marine aircraft lose more and more commonality. So much for one aircraft meets all service requirements. Well, it did it on paper. Look, we got it right in the 70s. Two of the greatest fighter jets of all time came out of it. The Air Force created the F-15 Eagle, and the Navy created the F-14 Tomcat. And note how different they are. So we get to the 80s. If it looks like a Hornet, it must be a Hornet, right? Well, if you make it 25% bigger, use the same overall plan form and approximately 42% fewer parts, and it shares the same bang seat and the same avionics, it becomes a, quote, derivative, unquote, thus getting a later suffix change instead of a new number. Hate to tell you all this, but if you're sitting down right, the F-18EF is a whole new airplane. It's a dance, folks. The Pentagon and Congress just love to do it. Let's call it the designation Cha-Cha-Ching. So let's stop feigning shock like Captain Renault in Casablanca. I'm shocked, shocked to find that there's gambling going on here. The F-35 is three airplanes for three different services with completely different requirements. But Congress insisted on one to save money, and that went well, didn't it? You need to get more bang for your buck. It's got to do more than one thing for one service. Unless you have a 30mm gun with depleted uranium shells, then you can be a one-trick pony. Rant over. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Wow. I love that, David.
This could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Yeah.
So how do you feel about tanker airplanes?
Oh, don't get him started.
Tankers are fine. They're very nice things. And they eventually pass gas to the guys that, how do I like, what do I think about tankers? There's no kick ass without tanker gas.
There you go.
That's great. Hey, David, I thought of you earlier today. I saw an article, but I misread it. I thought it said that the A-10 was coming this summer to Air Venture, but it was I misread it. It's the A-20, which is coming to Oshkosh this summer.
Quite a difference.
Yeah, quite a difference. I'm sure there'll be A-10s there also.
Very well done, David. Okay, now we have an On the Mark segment. Rob, you've got a recording for us.
Don't sound so surprised, Max.
Well, we haven't heard an On the Mark in quite some time.
Thanks, I appreciate that comment, Max.
So you're back at work. All right, so should I just play this?
You know, I don't think so. Why don't you just play it?
Okay.
I'm Rob Mark, and this is On the Mark. Is an airline flying fun these days? Sure it is. And to me, one of the best parts of flying is going through airport security. You're probably waiting for a sarcastic one-liner about now, but I'm absolutely serious about airport security and the TSA, even with all the press about how screener shortages are creating long security lines. But let me show you why airport security doesn't stress me out much anymore. This is my global entry card, and it's issued by the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol folks after I passed a background check and forked over $100. The card identifies me as a trusted traveler, and it's the heart of the TSA's pre-check system. Trusted traveler status means that I speed through security lines with no need to pull my laptop out of its bag or even lose my high tops. The card's good for 5 years, so moving to the front of the line only sets you back about $20 a year. PreCheck is such a bargain, in fact, the TSA figured they'd be overwhelmed with applications a few years ago. But they weren't. And the TSA had no idea why. The agency tried stirring up a little interest by randomly selecting passengers from the normal security lines and running them through the PreCheck system, and still, folks didn't sign up. So I decided to put on my marketing hat and figure out what the TSA could have possibly been doing wrong. Well, the answer was pretty easy. It turns out the TSA didn't tell anybody about the program. There were no brochures to be found at checkpoints explaining the finer points of the program or even the application process. I know what you're thinking. What about those people the screeners randomly selected? Surely they'd spend $20 a year for this kind of service? Well, maybe they might have if the TSA had bothered to give them any details about PreCheck. But no. TSA apparently only mentioned the computer and the shoes part of the PreCheck. They never mentioned the need to apply in order to continue receiving this privilege, so I guess they assumed the magnetic waves from the metal detectors would somehow magically plant the PreCheck seed in people's brains? Well, of course, that didn't work. So word on the street says TSA recently figured out this little marketing faux pas, but I'll believe that when I actually see some evidence. But there's no reason for you to wait for TSA to figure this all out. Just visit Customs and Border Patrol at cbp.gov and apply. $20 a year and you move to the head of the line. That could mean more time to buy those gourmet snacks before your next flight. Trust me on this one. PreCheck's a good deal. Oh, and you folks at TSA, be watching the mail soon for my consulting time invoice on this one. Glad I could be of help. From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark.
Very good, Rob.
I just had a tweak there. No, it was my version of David and the airplanes. You know, I mean, you just hate to see your government be stupid, but it's really bad when they're really stupid.
Yeah. Could we talk about the TSA for a minute?
Certainly.
I just sort of go, it's okay. But I thought there was a big campaign out for pre-check, or is it just that we're just surrounded by so many airline geeks that we know about it because everybody talks about it, that it just doesn't get out to the general public of the world?
Well, I think it's some of that. I mean, it's amazing to me the number of – and for people that have been traveling the last couple of years, you may have seen this where they would just grab people and stuff them in the pre-check line and they never mentioned a word to him. And people would say, well, what am I supposed – oh, you don't need to take your – I don't need to take my computer out? No, you don't need to take your shoes off. And we're all saying that because we're going, will you get out of the way? We went through here and we paid our $20 because we want to go faster and you're slowing the line down. And again, you'd have thought that when they did that, they'd have said, and if you really enjoyed not having to take off your shoes and take your laptop out of the bag, here's a form. All you got to do is fill it out and apply to pre-check and you'll be doing this all the time. But they never said a word to these people. And so I think a lot of people just assume that maybe they were already in it. And they screwed up, though.
They randomized it, right?
So, absolutely.
What I've learned from this is I certainly don't want to pay because if I get lucky, I'll get randomly pulled in there again. So why should I pay?
That's right. So they really did shoot themselves in the foot. Yeah. And now, of course, it's kind of a mess.
So I think the bigger mess is all the news articles are out right now saying, gosh, watch out for huge lines this summer. TSA is warning you. You'll get to the airport 3 hours early or whatever. This agency has gotten so much money, everything they've ever asked for. Is this just yet another ploy to get people to complain about bad service so that they can get more money? I mean, that's really –
I hope not.
Well, some of this is based on old budget numbers, too. I mean, this didn't just start. Let's face it. I mean, the TSA, like our friends at FAA, probably aren't the greatest when it comes to being strategic about anything. And they really didn't get the money that they wanted in the budget a couple of years ago. So they said they were short of people, and they just kind of didn't do much about it until now. And now all of a sudden, oh, my gosh, didn't we tell you guys we didn't get enough money a few years ago? We need more people.
Yeah, but look at this stuff they're doing. I mean, do you remember the TSA Viper highway checkpoints? I mean, they had so much money, they're out there, you know, figuring out how to check the highways for terrorists. I mean, it really bothers me with an agency, you know, has that much money, they're looking for ways to expand their services and then complain that they're not able to provide the basic service they're supposed to provide.
Yeah, $8 billion budget. And when you look at what happened after 9/11, they had a perfect opportunity to take, okay, granted, some areas they took FAA security and some other parts of the world and you know, kind of threw them all together to make up the DHS. But they could have started trying to do things a little differently, except that, of course, all the people running those departments came from other agencies and they didn't see any reason to change it. So here we are, you know, 15 years later with this big bureaucratic mess.
All right. Well, let's move ahead and talk about what's up with the geeks, at least from an aviation perspective. I'll start first and say nothing. nothing aviation related. David, you went to where did you go? You went to an air show recently.
I went to McGuire. We're recording this on Monday. It was the Sunday, the 15th. It was cold. It was windy.
Yeah.
I wasn't there very long. I'm not cut out for cold days on flight lines, but I did get to do something I've never done before, which was the Syracuse Air National Guard or the New York Air National Guard from Syracuse had their demonstration trailer down, and I flew an MQ-9 Reaper, sort of.
Really? Wow.
So I got to be in the box, and it was an interesting experience. It's different because I had somebody with me who was my weapon systems operator as I flew the aircraft. And there is an awful lot of interaction between the two people staring at the screen It was kind of for, I'm not a video game junkie, so it probably for someone who's a 17-year-old video game junkie, it probably wouldn't have been at all problem, but it's a lot of information flowing to me from my weapon systems operator to all of the screens that I needed to do to fly the mission. So pretty interesting technology. I guess we can include some pictures in it. Other than that, I did see the Breitling jet team, which was kind of cool. And it was basically an air show with 350,000 people.
Good grief. Wow.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about a base that's sandwiched between Philadelphia and New York. So they figure they had about 300,000 people a day come into the base.
That's phenomenal. That's great. All right, Rob, what's going on in your world? Anything interesting? Anything new?
Vacation.
Good. Are you taking your wife with you?
Actually, they're taking me. my wife and daughter are going to Aruba next week, and they said you can come with unless you want to stay home with the critters. And, of course, I thought about it. And
yeah, for like a second?
Yeah, kind of thought I'd go with them. So
good.
And we're traveling on an airline I've never flown on before, Copa.
Oh, good.
Out of O'Hare.
You have to give us a report.
Yeah, well, so if any of you have flown on Copa and you have anything to tell me, you better get to me pretty quick.
Okay. Max Trescott, what have you been flying lately?
Oh, I've been having lots of fun. On Saturday, I got a flight in Diamond's DA-40NG diesel. So that's the new, Fatic-controlled diesel engine. 168 horsepower turbocharged. So basically it's a Diamond, but with totally different controls for operating the engine. So for example, no mixture control, no prop control, but oh my gosh, does it start easily and is it really, really smooth? Much better than the older version with a normally aspirated engine. So that was kind of fun to fly and see what the differences are for that. We also had the California Air Expo here at Palo Alto for 2 days last week, and so I got my first up-close look at the new version of the Lancair Evolution, which has a Lycoming IO540 engine in it. The original Evolution was turbine, but this is a great way to, for hundreds of thousands of dollars less, get the pressurized aircraft and only lose about 30 knots of airspeed. So it's a pretty remarkable airplane. It is experimental, and so that means you can't buy it off the shelf. But there are companies out there which will help you complete it and do most of the work. So you end up paying one of these buyer assist type companies. So that was pretty fun. And the only other thing I want to mention is that our guest today, Shem, is absolutely right. The place where Google is testing their cars is my hometown right here. I see these things every day on the street in Mountain View, and he's absolutely correct. I have yet to see any snow here.
Yeah, there's some real challenges, I think.
We have had one accident that was in the newspaper here 2-3 weeks ago one of them just barely kind of sort of nudged up against the edge of a bus. It got confused because of construction cones on the side of the road. And one has been pulled over, one of our Mountain View City policemen.
For going too slow.
Yeah, he was like 20 or 25 in El Camino Real, which is 35. And he just wanted to know, hey, why are you going so darn slow? So, but there are multiple versions of these things, and they must have close to 100 of them. So we see them, every other minute, no matter where you look, there's one around somewhere.
All right. Well, listen, we have more listener mail than we can get to, is usually the case. But I think two items just to go through really quickly. One, because it's timely. And this comes from Nate. And this is concerning the issue of Frontier Airlines and the ACLU petition demanding reforms to Frontier's policies and practices with regard to mothers, breastfeeding mothers particularly. And this has been all over the news. Our friend Benet Wilson has written an article about this in the Runway Girl Network. NPR has got a lot of coverage of it and a number of others. And so we have quite a few links to these articles, so we'll put these in the show notes. In essence, I guess the idea is that There is this perception that Frontier Airlines is not as accommodating as it needs to be towards mothers who are breastfeeding, expressing milk, pumping milk, having the facilities where they can do that. Some of the issues that occur with women who are nursing if they don't express their milk, and that can cause some serious health problems and so forth. So this is getting a lot of press these days. You've probably seen some of it, and we'll kind of put a summary of that in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com/401, and so you can take a look at that.
I can't believe it's even an issue.
I know. In this day and age, this is 2016, right?
Yeah, it does make you kind of wonder. And how many women are on the board of directors at Frontier? I bet we can guess. Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
But, maybe you know, that shouldn't even make any difference. I mean, if someone raises that issue, they need to have women on the board in order to make the guys get it? I mean, come on.
Yeah, good point. We should be well beyond you know, the dark ages of discrimination and just a lack of understanding. At Pratt & Whitney, when I worked there, I mean, years ago, they established lactation rooms where, you know, private areas where women who were breastfeeding, nursing could pump their milk. I think there were, well, I don't know what's in there because I didn't go in there, but I think that there were refrigeration facilities, refrigerators, things like that. It's just sort of basic stuff that you would think that, you know, every company was sensitive to these days. And so there's apparently, as I say, those who feel that Frontier Airlines has not been as responsive as they need to be in this day and age. So I think we'll all be hearing a lot more about that, you know, in the coming weeks and months. One other item I just wanted to mention from Philip, and we heard about this from several different listeners. This is a report from the Australian Transport Safety Bureau, air data system failure involving Airbus A320. This is concerning an obstruction in a pitot tube. And, you know, I just did like a little Googling around, and I just found example after example after example where there have been accidents or turnbacks or incidents resulting from wasps building nests in or around pitot tubes, obstructing pitot tubes. I mean, even including an Airbus with 175 people having to land. We've seen an accident in the past. Bergen Air Flight 301, that was a 757. That was back in 1996. All on board were killed in that accident. In that case, a wasp nest blocked the pitot tube. I don't know. I'm kind of confused. I mean, isn't protecting pitot tubes a relatively easy thing to do? And how come we have all these accidents regarding this? I don't know. Rob, any thoughts on this?
Pitot covers?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, if they can do it in 2 hours, of course, if the airplane were sitting on the ground couple hours, I don't think they put covers on the pitots, but I guess if you were in a climate where this was already an issue, you would have thought somebody would have said, you know what, let's put the pitot covers on.
I would think so. Yeah.
Or could you not put a very fine mesh across them to let the air pass through but not let the bugs get in? I don't know.
I don't know. Shem, any thoughts on this topic?
Well, my thought, you can't do a whole lot for various PO2 problems other than having separate ways of determining airspeed. For example, the 787 and the A350 have various artificial airspeed means, and there's other ways. But it comes again down to training of the human. So if you have a system component failure, the person is able to understand how to work around that and operate through separate means. And that, again, is just a matter of a training for that resilience. There's a good example of the human having to make up the gap between our idealized world and reality. In this case, reality is you don't have any airspeed. And on a jet airplane, it will affect all sorts of subsystems and will have all sorts of secondary failures, which may seem confusing and mismatched and actually may not follow any particular path. In other words, you can't even program a simulator to do it because each time it's actually different.
depending on the mode of failure, how quickly they do it. And the only way around that is to get the human the kind of training and experience so they have the resilience to make up for that gap.
Wow.
There's no other solution that's really going to solve it.
Yeah, I was just surprised to see how many examples of this problem has occurred over the years. Very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, one other part, of course, is just looking, you know, inspecting them. And part of our, you know, pre-flight or when we walk up the airplanes, we look at the pitot tubes. But, of course, I can't see if there's anything in them because the pitot tubes of my airplane are about close to 20 feet off the ground. So I can just look them and make sure there's not a cover on them and they're not broken off. And that's about it.
What's the diameter of the hole in a pitot tube?
It's not very big. You know, for a smaller airplane, of course, it's, you know, maybe a millimeter. On a bigger airplane, it's only a couple, maybe 2 or 3 millimeters at most. They're not big. I don't usually get close to them.
Yeah, I didn't think so. I just was, I found it odd that, you know, wasps, mud daubers, these kinds of things could get into such a small little hole that easily, but I guess they can.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah. All right, well, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. I want to thank you all for listening. Again, our guest was Captain Shem Malmquist. Shem, thanks again for joining us. Really fascinating conversation.
Well, thank you, and it's been a privilege.
And we'll have links to the sites that Shem mentioned where we can find him and some of the other resources. We'll have all those in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com/401. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. We'll start with you, David Vanderhoof. Where do folks find you?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, or you can find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, talking about UAVs on the UAV Digest.
And Rob Mark, how about you?
Well, anything that has Jet Wine in the name on Facebook or on Twitter or just about anything, I'd say.
Okay. And Max Trescott, how about you?
Well, let's see, the usual places, g1000book.com for my books or sjflight.com for flight training. And just to close out one thought, since this is episode 400 for me, I heard you guys talk last week about what kind of memories you have. And I just wanted to say, this is just about the 100th episode for me here with you guys.
Is
and
it
I
really?
What I didn't really expect going into it was what a great friendship we'd develop and how much fun I'd have during the week, sending emails and tweets and other stuff back and forth with you. So there's a lot of stuff, folks, that goes on behind the scene here. And we have one heck of a good time. So anyway, I just wanted to thank all of you and say this has been a heck of a lot of fun. I enjoy our friendship, not just when we get together on the evenings that we record the show.
Absolutely. And we enjoy you as well.
Thanks.
All right. I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn. David mentioned the UAVDigest.com. Also with Mary Kirby at the PaxX Podcast. That's at PaxXPodcast.com. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. As we mentioned before, show notes for this episode are at airplanegeeks.com/401. Opening music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his compositions at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.
All right, David.